Welcome, everybody. It's interesting, isn't it? We're going to talk about the news. This gentleman here actually has a newspaper. Many people don't know what one of them is, actually, I'm pretty sure. So I'm going to talk a bit about, I do a lot of work in evidence-based medicine, and I do a lot of work with the media, and I'm going to talk about why you all should do a bit more yourselves. So this is all aimed at you to get involved, okay? So, first thing is, there's a lot of out there. These are the views per month. Individuals reaching in thousands, so about 18 million people. The number one paper in the UK is the Daily Mail, followed by The Sun, The Mirror, and down here, and then you get to The Express, and in the middle is all the sort of the Sunday Times and Independent. So lots of news. Our consumption of news is actually going up. Could have done a talk about how it was 20 years ago with much more print, and with the advent of computers and their mobile phones, how we're consuming more news than ever. But my favourite paper is, I thought I'd start with the Daily Mail. And the Daily Mail's a great paper for healthcare headlines. Loads of really interesting stories about processed meat, heavy web use harms a child's health, poison by everyday life, sunbed lethal is a cigarette. Now, it's interesting to note, why does this appear and why does it keep happening? It's incredibly prevalent to have healthcare news headlines. Is the editors know that you will click on these headlines. So you are part of the problem in that, you know what it's like, you know this is fake, but you can't wait to get in there and find out. So on the portable, on the phone, we all go in, and this increases and goes up. And even in Oxford, we contribute to some of these. These are stories that obesity in women is dangerous as a terror threat. And this is an Oxford study. Don't drink more than 3 glasses of wine a week. And so what's also interesting is, how do these stories get interpreted? And I'm very fascinated by healthcare headlines. And when I first did this talk, I sent out on Twitter a request for people for their favourite headline. And this is David, who's running this week. Here's David's favourite healthcare headline. And so... So David has an interest in exercise and lifestyle. And this is the sort of evidence that he spends his time looking up about. But you know, it's interesting, isn't it? As we look at this stuff, you think, well, how does this impact on the decisions we make? And as I've shown you, here's my favourite. Your fridge is a major killer. You just don't know it. But here's my other favourite paper in the whole world, the Daily Express. The Daily Express definitely trumps the Daily Mail, and I'll show you why. I'm going to come to a headline which I know, but this is just about dementia. I started collecting news stories about dementia from the Daily Express, thinking, what could I learn? Simple way to fight off dementia. Actually, it's a stressful lifestyle. And then I started to think, well, this is a bit odd. Chocolate can halt dementia, but lose weight to beat dementia. So how can anybody know how you can eat lots of chocolate and lose weight? It's quite an interesting issue. You know how to do it. You don't eat anything else. So you're going to go on the chocolate diet to stave off dementia. And it keeps going. Daily drink, aspirin, new way to fight dementia, and even red wine pill stops dementia. And so I was getting really excited. You know what you're like as a researcher? You like collecting data, don't you? We like to collect things. But what happened is this started to get a bit of a serious addiction for me. In that they started to increase and increase. Now, qualitative researchers will love this. I thought, well, actually, what we'll do is we'll take the headlines and try and create some themes. So I started putting them into themes. So here, there's something about healthy living over here in lifestyle, something about drugs and chocolate, simple ways and to fight dementia, something about tests and spicy diet. So I started to organise them into, is that a thematic analysis, Veronica? Is that fair? What do you call that? Is that...
It's the beginning.
The beginning of being a qualitative. And when I did that, I noticed I started to be able to fill in the dots even more, and ended up like this with these 8 different ways of looking at how we're going to beat dementia. So you can lose weight, eat chocolate, keep busy, and have a healthy life. You can do puzzles, take some drugs, and have some tests, and watch your diet. And the Daily Express tells you how to do that. But you know this is all bullshit when you look at all of them and you're knowing this is what's going to happen in 10 years' time. And that's the issue here, isn't it? You start to go, and look, anybody can add in another one there. Loads of really interesting headlines that we're all the time looking at and pressing, let's have a look. And I know that because the editor of The Express, his favourite topic is statins. His wife took a statin, and his wife then got some muscle pains and decided to stop taking the statin, and so he became obsessed by statins. And what happened in doing that is they, I think, about tripled their readership when they put a story about statins on the front page. So they're always looking for statins. But what interested me is the circularity of all this. So this is the one headline: take statins to save your life. And then you go, oh, this pops up, statins in a health alert. Interesting. And part of that health alert is the next one is it causes diabetes. However, in causing diabetes, we're going in a bad direction. It's going to cause chaos. But in causing chaos, we're back to proof statins save millions, and we come back in a circularity again. And we'll get the whole thing. And this is what happens in about a year. And these news headlines keep getting recycled in a way if a piece of evidence emerges that actually fits this narrative. And you can keep going, you can have loads of fun with The Express, you can do cancer, you can do whatever you want in headlines. And some of these are verging on the ridiculous. Drug to cure 9 in 10 cancers, rhubarb can save your life. And they sort of feel a bit like fun until you meet the first patient who says, I've stopped taking treatment and now I'm taking rhubarb instead. And I was describing a patient I've seen who basically came off his chemotherapy because this is a real life case, started to take coffee enemas instead. And they will not, anybody in medical care at some point is involved will find somebody who goes on one of these news headlines to take an alternative path. And I can come back to what I think the issues are. But so it's interesting. So Google's official blog, about 1% of all searches on the internet now, and that's, you know, you don't have to think that's millions, if not, gosh knows how many that, are about people just looking up symptoms. And that includes you lot. When you have a symptom, you go, oh, I'm going to look it up and see if there's a miracle cure or what's going on. But interestingly, they've sort of started to take a position to start to think about their role in healthcare. Now, you think it's because they're going to do healthcare for they want to do the right thing. They've realized, like the Daily Express, this is a business. And in doing it better, you'll come to Google more often. But again, the evidence of these self-checkers, and there is this paper which is in the BMJ, that shows when you look at the symptom checkers, there were 23 symptom checkers provided. The correct diagnosis was only available a third of the time in these online forums. And you start to think, what's going on here? If you think about the drivers of healthcare, when is this appropriate for people to check something and go, well, that means I need to go and see my doctor, or actually I can stay at home? Interested in its own right, the potential to create chaos in more work or inappropriate work. So I'm going to take you back in time. Here's my girls again. Those on the MSC saw them this year. This is going back to 2009. Okay, remember 2009? There are most people when we're all going to die. Okay. Remember that? Daily Express, we're on alert for the new super flu. It's not about Jonathan Ross and his wife. Is swine flu already here? Now the battle to contain it starts. Now it gets really serious. Now you're really interested in the news because it's going to kill 350 people every day. Yeah. We are in panic mode and you can't go on your holidays. Just like when you think about Brexit, you won't be able to go on your holidays. You couldn't go on the holidays in 2009. But what was the problem? And then if you really think about it, it got even worse when you're going to go, we're all going to die. Interesting. So what's happening? Now, interestingly, some of that was based on fake and some of it's based on real experts and what we do. Now, going back to the swine flu, remember, some of you should now be dead. Donald Rumsfeld, remember the known unknowns and unknowns, whatever you know, you don't know. Well, he actually, this is an article in The Independent, he actually had shares in a company called Gilade, who had the intellectual property to Tamiflu. And he, this is an article about him saying, he ordered this UN report into how many predicted deaths would bird flu cause. Now, who'd like to have a go at a number? How many deaths do you think would be by bird flu? You can go either UK-based or worldwide. 10? 20? A couple of 100? A couple of 1,000?
5,000.
You're going to go 5,000? That feels pretty high, doesn't it? Anybody like to go higher or lower? Because this is the important, if you're going to think about stockpiling drugs and thinking about we're all going to die, how many people in a UN report were predicted to die? We have 5,000. How many of you think lower? Hands up. How many of you think higher? Oh, you're all a bit higher. How many? That lady there with the green scarf on.
170 million.
170 million, bloody hell. Fuck, man. Actually, not too bad, actually. In fact, we revert some of the 700,000 deaths that might be expected in the UK alone. Yeah? So it was 700,000 deaths worldwide were predicted. So what, actually, although it sounds laughable, you weren't that far out. Yeah? So we predicted. So no wonder everybody goes into panic mode. But this stuff really gets into our psyche and has an impact on policy. So you can calculate what's called the news to death ratio. So in the first 24th of April 2009, in the first 13 days of the swine flu outbreak, you can look at the number of deaths in terms of swine flu. So there were 31 deaths for swine flu. In the same 13 days, for TB, there were 63,066 deaths. The number of news articles for swine flu were 250,000 versus 6,500 for TB. So that gives you a news to death ratio of 8,176 news articles for one death. But actually, every time you see a news article on TB, there'll be 10 deaths. Now, that was done by a guy called Hans Rosling. I pinched that off him. But it's got a very important message in the distortion about how the news comes at you. Because this is a major killer. And is really important in terms of its health impact. But nobody gives a monkey's dizzy about it. Nobody cares about it in any way. And I think all of us go into this area and think, where's the excitement? But this is a huge killer. Now, we published the Cochrane Review in this area, got the unpublished data, and did lots of fun, and I published all sorts of stuff that says, I wouldn't give this to under 12s, it's got huge problems. We published all of the research, and I thought we would change practice. And we ended up saying in 2014, £550 million we spent on stockpiling this drug, and it's a waste of time. The reason it's a waste of time is it does have a symptomatic effect, a bit like paracetamol. The evidence shows it reduces your temperature, reduces some of the symptoms of flu. But it doesn't reduce the important complications of flu, like bacterial infections, hospital admissions, all of the things you would want it to do if you were going to stockpile it. It doesn't actually prevent you from getting flu when you look in the back of the evidence. I went to a parliamentary committee in 2014, and this is when it hit home. And we spent about 2 hours laying all this out and leaving that committee thinking all of the people in the government get this issue. And a week later, we spent £50 million more stockpiling it because the stockpile we had was going out of date. And they said, we can have it cheap. You can have it at half price if you renew your stockpile. So I also think there's a huge agenda with our policy people thinking about how we inform policy in an evidence-based way. That's part of our job in research, is to think about how do we arm the next generation of policy people to look at evidence. So some people this morning will have been on the MSc course and seen this graph where there are sort of four steps to evidence-based practice. Ask a question, acquire some evidence, appraise the quality, and apply it in practice. Now, when I'm thinking about applying this to the media and thinking about how I go about a process of informing the news and what we do in healthcare, I slightly flip that round and I use it in a different way. I have an extra step. So I focus. You can see instead of asking questions here, there's an extra step that's gone in. So I think about acquiring the best evidence and assessing the effect all the time. When I get asked about media questions or healthcare evidence, I think, is this the best evidence? And what's the size of the effect? This step is deliberately smaller because we never get to the biases often. Because by the time you're in the biases, most people don't understand what we're on about. If I'm having a discussion in a newspaper about confounding and indication bias, confounding by indication, and the people are going, oh, we're not interested. Nobody's going to understand this. So I focus on these two areas and I'll show you how I do it. So the first step is I always think about is when I see some evidence, I ask a general question. Is this the highest level of evidence to answer this question? That's my first step. And often what you'll see is, for instance, within the sort of process of evidence, you'll see lots of news headlines that are down here. It might actually be just an animal study. Well, if it's an animal study, it'll take 20 years to get into practice, and only about 1 in 10 of them will get into practice. So when they say we've got a new cure for dementia and it's in mice, you're thinking, well, 1 in 10 chance in 20 years. There's your quote. Whereas what you're thinking is, where are we in the evidence hierarchy? And to do that and inform that, you generally want to be up the hierarchy, don't you? You want to be up near the systematic review end. And to do that, you need a very good understanding of this one table, which is the levels of evidence. What type of question is it? And where are we in this matrix? And if we're down here, we know we've got some issues, whereas I want to be up here at the higher end of the evidence to think about the systematic reviews. So I'll give you an example of how we applied that. We did this for evidence for what's called IVF add-ons. We was approached by the BBC, who said, we're going to do a story about all of these add-on treatments that you can get in addition to IVF. So we did two things. The first thing is we said, well, let's look at the websites and look at what the claims are and how many times they actually, when they state a claim, they cite a bit of evidence. And then ask a question is it the highest level of evidence? Is it actually a systematic review? Because if you were having a new treatment, you would want to be saying it's backed up by a systematic review. And in doing that, we showed that actually they were all miserable. That actually they often on the websites didn't cite any evidence. And when they did, they actually went to lower quality or opinions. And when we went searching for the evidence, we could only find evidence 5 times where there was some evidence backed up by systematic reviews where you think there might be an effect, and then discuss the effect sizes. Now, in just doing that very simple bit, we got to a point where most of the Royal College of Obs and Gynae, and there are some people in here, went mad at us and said, you have no idea what you're on about. Well, remember, my job is I'm a GP. I said, I'm a GP, so my job is to try and inform people. If they come in and say, I'm thinking of having some IVF, what do you think about embryo glue? Well, I can tell you most GPs have no idea what to do in that situation. So there has to be some way of saying, where's the evidence? He said, what do you think you're doing explaining what the evidence is when you're not an obstetrician or a gynecologist? Well, I said, I thought that's what we're trying to do. And all we've done is say, what's the evidence in terms of its level? And not even gone yet into the effect sizes. 2 years later, when you think about difference, this has been really interesting. So for about 2 years, went round in circles. And then early at the end of just this, the end of last year, the HFEA, who are the Human Fertilisation and Embryo Authority, did a whole review where they brought together a system, which I think is a huge step forward based on the research. And what they did is said, here we're going to provide you with the evidence, but they did something really smart, which I quite like. They have a traffic light system, which is, their traffic light system is red, amber, green. And the red there is, this is assisted hatching, it talks you out of the risk, what's the evidence, and it says, there is no evidence, you can't see that, you need, that this add-on is effective and safe. That's a red light. When they have a green, they say there is at least evidence from at least 2 randomised controlled trials. And in the amber, they go, it's uncertain, the evidence is conflicting, and it needs reducing uncertain. And I quite like that system, because the traffic light system helps you really simply think, okay, what's the evidence? What's it like? Is there any evidence? If the answer is no, you've got a red. If there's more than 2 trials, at least you're on the pathway to somewhere. And you can start to filter out a lot of evidence really simply by just asking, what type of evidence is it? And is it appropriate to answer this question? Now, the second step then is assessing the effect. Okay, and that's difficult because you're really thinking about patient benefit. So I often think about, this is an equation in my mind that I think about, and it's patient benefit is directly proportional to the outcome. The bigger the outcome, the more benefit. The better the outcome, the more benefit. The more relevant the outcome, the more patient benefit. See that? So if I say you get a 2-year reduction in mortality, you might think, well, that's an important outcome. However, it's inversely proportional to the bias. The more bias, the less patient benefit. And if you introduce biases, you're overcoming the patient benefit. Now, that's really important in your thinking, because if there's only a very small outcome benefit, any small bias will overcome the patient benefit. If there's a rather large outcome and a big outcome, you might accept more bias. So it's a simple way. And then the third thing is you need the optimal information size. That's what systematic reviews are about. Have I got sufficient information to be able to say with some certainty this is a true effect? It's not the big data. You know, it's not all the information, because people get overwhelmed with, we've got 3 million patient years. What you're interested in, have I got the right amount of information? And so one of the things to think about is to start with, I optimise the outcome. This is my second step. And I ask a very simple question all the time. Does this make a difference? And if it doesn't make a difference, why do you even need to care about the biases? Why do you even need to care about whether you've got optimal information? Why not just stop? And you can stop and filter out a lot of information really quickly. Now, it's not quite, there are bits though to, does it make a difference? Okay? And I think about 3 questions to that when I'm doing that. Yeah. And in assessing the effect, I have these 3 questions. Who does it apply to? Does it apply to the actual people we see or the patients we see? Does it make an actual difference, both positive and negative, the benefits and the harms? And is it actually feasible? Yeah? And so you will have to think, and they're the 3 questions I'm often putting in at this step. So if we come back to the IVF example, yeah? The first thing you would expect to happen is that anything that makes a claim for an intervention will be backed up by some evidence. Some of these treatments are of no benefit to you whatsoever, and some of them are harmful. And that's going into the speech. But it's going into, for instance, which ones? And here, only one treatment called an endometrial scratch was supported by moderate quality evidence it would help. It involved a procedure to scratch the womb lining to help an embryo successfully implant, although the evidence for this treatment was not itself beyond doubt. In fact, what's happened is this was the only one that was a moderate evidence of benefit. A large randomized controlled trial has come out in the last month that says it's of no benefit. So we often get this early stage where things look promising, but as you go along, they're no better. So you get by asking, here's another one. Thinking about the outcome, does it make a difference? So this is an interesting paper came out in the BMJ. I got asked to quote on this, so I don't know anybody here quoted for the media, or part of it or not. You're on the Science Media Centre, aren't you? Mm-hmm. List, anybody else get asked to make a quote? Do you? Do you actually quote?
Yes, sometimes.
Sometimes? Is it difficult, or do you do it really quickly and integrate
it? It's difficult. I spend a bit of time, and usually,
Yeah, yeah. So it feels like sometimes it's going to take you forever, and that's why we don't participate. This is real. Oh, I'm going to be quoted in the news. I'm going to spend half a day, read the evidence. Oh, my God. In fact, I haven't got the time to do that anymore. So I actually think, oh, this is really interesting. I'll have a quick read while I'm having a cup of tea, and I think about my framework, okay? And I think, all right, I'm going to quote on the outcomes. And here's me being quoted. Here's what I actually said. And that's what I said. I wonder if these make a difference. And I wrote a quote back to the Science Media saying, it's hard to understand why half the drugs were approved in the first place if they provide no clinical meaning benefit, he said. And that's it, done. That took me about 5 minutes reading it, because they're going with a very structured approach to what I'm looking for in the evidence, as opposed to just reading it and hoping some amazing quote will emerge. I go in and say, does this make a difference today? And as I said to you, if it doesn't make a difference, why would you carry on? That's my quote. So there's the sort of approach to benefit. And I think if you think about outcomes, we haven't touched any of the other two bits. I've taught you two things. Is this the appropriate evidence to answer this question? And then these three questions throughout: does it make a difference? Does this apply to my patients? And is the treatment feasible in my setting? Okay? And you want to think about optimizing them. So sometimes I get asked things like research and I dismiss it immediately, because I'm asking, this is a question about, does this apply to my patient? And in thinking about it, I think, does this apply to me? So effect of breakfast on weight and energy intake, a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. This was a trial of whether you eat breakfast or should stop eating breakfast. Yeah. How many people don't eat breakfast? Okay. Do you actually care about whether you should or shouldn't and whether it has an impact on your weight loss? I don't care, actually. It depends how much time I've got in the morning. If I lie in too late and I'm running late, I might not have breakfast. At the weekends, I have breakfast. So I'm like, this doesn't even apply to the people I see. Why would anybody even care about the effect of breakfast? Nobody's ever come into my clinic and said, Dr. Hennigan, I'm really thinking about whether I should give up breakfast or not. What's your advice? I've never seen anybody. So it doesn't mean but what I'm saying to you is, this is a dramatic example of, is this the sort of evidence that applies to the people you see in practice? If it's not, I wouldn't waste your time. I'd move on. Now, you could read it if you're interested, okay, or all sorts of reasons. Now, at the moment, I am feeling a little bit stressed, actually, at the moment, because I got involved in something that I'm not sure I should have got involved in, but I have done, because it's a really evidence-based issue. This is a piece, I did a piece with Panorama, which was about gender dysphoria and the drug treatments in children. And these things now in the world are incredibly emotive. And I don't... My question is not whether they're right or wrong. It's the one thing I do is say, what does the evidence look like? Have we got sufficient evidence for somebody to make an informed judgment? And in terms of children, you'd think, well, actually, you would want robust evidence, wouldn't you? These are very powerful treatments we're going to use. So if we're going to go down this route, this is a good example of how we should frame the whole of medicine, how we should think about what we do. Now, the problem is in healthcare is, boy, do we jump on bandwagons. There's a huge history of just trying treatments and going down a route because we think they can work. And in this article, I said we've got ourselves into a complete mess here. Because about 7 or 8 years into this, we have got in a position where we've given out these powerful drugs, and now we're going, more people want them, and now we're going, oh, and what's the evidence? And I looked at the evidence and went, oh my God, this is abysmal. It's worse than the IVF. Now, I can handle with the IVF, because the problem in an IVF, if you get it wrong, is, okay, you don't have a child. That's pretty bad. But if you get it wrong in somebody who's having really powerful drugs, wouldn't we as society want to be thinking about the difference we make? Now, all I've done is say, what's the quality of the evidence? Now, on one side of this argument, people think I'm amazing. On the other side of this argument, they think I'm an absolute nightmare. The devil himself, and it feels like that because of the ideology. And all I'm doing is, I've not said anything apart from this should be done in a research context. If we're going to go down this route, we have to develop the research evidence, and we have to do it in a really robust way. And there are so many unanswered questions and so many uncertainties, we have to have a different approach. And at the moment, we seem to be going, it's all right, nobody wants to go there, because we're all a bit scared of the amount of stuff we'll get happening. But if we can't do it for this in children, what are we going to do in the whole of society? And I think these are really interesting issues we now face. We are bringing treatments and innovations and new devices and technologies in a way that we've never seen before. Innovation is the word on the street. And in doing that, we want to ignore the evidence, apart from when it suits us. So one thing is to do, now I've learned, is when I'm going to go somewhere controversial, I always write a piece to go with it. So I've had some pieces today that have gone, you've said this, and I go, well, I didn't say that. And so instead of trying to answer it back, I go, here's what I said. If you go here, you can read my review of the evidence and what my conclusions are at the end of the article. If you disagree with them, so some people right now disagree with systematic reviews are an important way of informing the public. They think they're terrible. And I go, well, okay, that's all right, but we use systematic reviews, and here they are. And in there, I took the individual studies and said, what do they look like in terms of the effects and the quality? And I think this is something I've learned. If you're going to join the media and have a go and say things, you should always have a backup where you go, actually, here's my viewpoint here. I published it in some blog or some piece where actually this is what I said. And that helps you a lot, because it gives you, if somebody misquotes you, and I think that's what everybody's worried about, you join in and suddenly somebody will translate something, you said something, into something surreal or something. You go, I didn't say that. And that's what happens. So, I'm just going to end up now, and then we can have a few questions. There's a whole new world out there, and that world is Facebook and social media, and bypasses. So the newspapers have sometimes they put really good stuff up there. Sometimes they put, as you've seen, shocking stuff up there. But a lot of the time, they're sort of in the middle. But this type of stuff has huge impact, because a large majority of health news shared on Facebook is fake or misleading. And that's what everybody's in their ideology is, sharing information. So the question is, in healthcare, is what's the role of researchers in informing the public? And if you look last year in the 10 most shared health articles on social media, and this was in a way of just a simple measure of trying to say most of them are low or very low in terms of scientific credibility. The three that weren't were here were 6, 7, and 8. And 6 is about cold or flu symptoms. Here's how to tell the difference. One about stem cell treatment, and the other was about how cycling in old age can keep your immune system young. Shared a lot. So we all like cycling in old age. But the other ones are, this one finds marijuana is 100 times less toxic than alcohol, and it's safer than tobacco. That's the most shared story on social media last year. That's because all the people, I guess, who want to take their marijuana quite like that message and want to pass it on to everybody else. So it's a really interesting arena in terms of what's our role as researchers in informing the public, and how might you go about that? And I think we do have a huge role to play. And this is Fiona Fox, who runs the Science Media Centre, who do a great job. They have a system where they recruit people who will comment on news stories, and David's on that list, and I get stories. But what she said in there was really insightful. And she was commenting on this lady, Jenny Ron, who said, "I'm leaving the thought of world because you can't beat fake news with science communication." And her arguments were trying to say that actually, I am seeing plenty to reassure me that the public are more discerning. The latest trust rating showed once again that scientists remain near the top of the list of most trusted professionals, with 83% of the public trusting scientists to tell the truth, compared with only 17% who say the same about politicians. So if you're involved in research, the public trust you to say the right things. And in doing that, I think it's helpful to say, what she said is finishing, is say, no one said it was going to be easier, and I'm open to Rome's claims that it might be getting harder, or at least more bruising. I think that is true. The world is more bruising than ever now, if you just try and put out a very clear message about here's the evidence. But that's all the more reason for Rome and her fellow scientists to hang in there. Now would be the very worst time for scientists to return to their ivory towers. Now, I'm just going to finish with some things it doesn't matter what I do, I can't do anything about. And it doesn't matter what you try, what your strategy is, there are some things you just can't do something about. And here's one. Now, having finished that, just to say, one of the things I'm having a bit of trouble at the moment is sleeping. Anybody else got a problem with sleeping in the room? Yeah, it's sort of like, I'm all right with it, but what I do is I rely on the Daily Express to inform what I might do about it. And those of you who sleep too much, you see you're in trouble, I'm all right, I'll be fine. But it's actually, I'm using the Daily Express to help me out. Thank you very much.